It's Wednesday, December 27th, 2006, and you're listening to episode 32 of Fear the Boot, the show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 58 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and everybody's sitting all out of order, just ruining my life.
It is my chaotic good fellow host that I blame.
So
it's
on
the crazy episode.
On the blue mic is John.
Hey.
And on the black mic is Adam.
Hi.
And then on the gray mic is Chad.
Howdy.
And normally that's kind of flipped-ish, except I guess, Adam, you're on the gray mic, John's on the black, and the Chad's on the... Or how does that go normally?
I usually sit over there.
Uh-huh.
I'm Chad, Adam's me, and Chad is Adam.
Wow.
Today.
How confusing.
But you're still Dan.
Sorry.
Do continue with your Danliness.
Okay. Continue with my Danliness. If you guys send in any emails to Fear the Boot, I want to let you guys know that we do respond to all of our email. I try to do it within about 24 hours, but even if I fail that, I will write you back in a couple days. But a lot of the email domains out there, like Yahoo and such, are dumping our emails into your spam folder. So if you write us, be sure to watch your spam folder, because there's a really good chance that we will write you back in a short order of time, and it's gone into your spam folder.
Another problem we have with this is my Fear the Boot inbox has 1,000 emails in it, and I would say probably 975 of them are spam.
Yeah, this is also the result of you guys forwarding. See, I keep up with this on a day-by-day basis. Like, daily... My Fear the Boot email only gets about 10 or 20 spam messages.
Really? My Gmail account gets no spam messages.
Well, that's because you kept your Gmail account hidden. My Gmail account gets quite a few. It does a pretty good job of sorting them, but it gets quite a few. So, anywho, if you guys email us and we don't write you back, watch your spam folder, because I actually had somebody real recently say, hey, I wrote you like 2 weeks ago and never heard back from you. Check my sent mailbox. And yeah, sure enough, I had written this guy. He just never got the email because... Yahoo or whatever it was, I don't remember the domain, picked it up as spam and dumped it in a bulk folder.
Well, that's because of all that mailing list that Fear the Boot sends
well,
out.
Well, Fear the Boot also has a booming Viagra business.
Oh, yes.
We do insiders.
Tramadol. Oh, and Mr. John Odagu from Nigeria contacted me the other day. We're going to come and do a lot of money, guys.
Excellent.
We are. All we have to do is send about $5,000, and that's going to free up, like, what is it, several million that we're going to get.
Oh, yeah, 10 million.
But Fear the Boot also, we do booming mortgage trades. We do... insider stock information.
Absolutely. We've really incorporated ourselves into pretty much every single major market in this country.
Yeah. Adam's starting up the naked celebrity Photoshop.
Fear the Boot .xxs, babe.
That's right. Fear the Boot .xxx / Britney Spears. It's coming soon, and you guys are going to like
that. That already came, dude.
Oh, let's see what else is on the radar today. If you want to give back to Fear the Boot, because obviously we deliver this podcast like completely free with no commercials.
We're setting up a donations page. Send your money now.
Yeah, which we're not doing. But a couple people have asked us, hey, is there anything we can do for you guys? The answer is, well, really twofold. One is tell your friends. And secondly, wherever you listen to us, be it iTunes or if you go through like dig.com or whatever, go out there and throw us up a review or something. That's really, I mean, the biggest thing we could use back from you guys. This is not a business. We're not making any money off of it. We don't take donations. Just, you know, spread the word about us. Let other people know.
And come to our forums. It makes us feel good.
Yeah,
it does.
Yeah, do get involved in our community. We've got a great community out there.
Join our WoW Guild. We're awesome.
That's right.
Nice.
Nice subtle slide in there, John. I like that.
Yep.
I got a voicemail from a guy on our forum named Runester. That's his handle. That is not his real name.
Not him.
And Runester sent in a voicemail. And by the way, our voicemail information, if you go to feartheboot.com, look on the contact page, right there we've got a list of ways you can get a hold of us. And we do have a voicemail box, which is strangely, I believe, in like the Seattle area, even though we live in the Midwest. But for whatever reason, that's where it is. And Runester off our forum sent us a voicemail that I wanted to run past you guys. We were talking in the last episode. Chad was talking in the last episode about how he gets annoyed by the Lord of the Rings template in a lot of fantasy stories.
Now,
let me just say real quick.
I like Lord of the
Rings.
Right.
We're not dissing Lord of the Rings. To explain what we're talking about, Chad has a beef with how a lot of fantasy stories use that sort of Lord of the Rings template.
A lot of modern fantasy.
A lot of modern fantasy.
Where post-Tolkien, which is the whole genre anyway.
Right. Where your whole story is about travel, where you have to save the maiden, avenge your father, throw the ring in the volcano, whatever it may be, And this objective either is, or by the end of the story, will be thousands of miles away. And the story is all about all the things you do along the way. And I think this is even true of a lot of role-playing games, that as people are at the role-playing plots, typically the beginning and end of a story are never visibly in the same city. That there's some amount of huge travel that comes between the two. And we got a voicemail from Runester, who said that he had to wonder if some of this was an age thing. And we don't mean a maturity thing, but just about a where you're at in your life sort of thing. Because what he was saying was that he noticed that when he was a younger adult, like teenager, as most teenagers are, he wanted to get out there and explore the world and do things. He noticed that most of his games were about getting out there, exploring the world and doing things. But as he got older, and he personally wanted to start settling down, that he noticed his taste in stories also tended to be more about great varieties of things happening in a relatively small area. All the politics surrounding a city or the beginning and end of a plot were visibly always within the same region. And I was curious what you guys, my fellow hosts, thought of his theory there, that the kinds of story that someone likes in terms of the distance traveled has a lot to do with your subconscious desires that are being spawned by just your life position, where you're at in life right now.
In arguing against that point, I will completely support his point.
That makes perfect sense.
Unmeaningful.
Well, you are, Chad.
What? What I am saying is that when we were teenagers, and Dan, you and I were talking about this, the sort of, you know, Lord of the Rings template in every level of fantasy and all these role-playing games that we both ran,
right,
and played modules and then had other people run, were all this sort of travel Lord of the Rings thing. When we were teenagers, when we were in that phase of wanting to get out and see the world, we stopped doing it. And we rebelled against that. And we very purposefully started to run games that were counter to that. Now, my point is that, you know, obviously Runester's wrong because we didn't do that, but in analyzing my argument, that completely supports his argument because we were rebellious.
Right.
We were rebellious teenagers.
I think, yeah, it's hard to separate how much of that was age versus how much of that was us being countercultural.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess really, if you talk about all of this being kind of the subconscious product of age, that's the point of subconscious, is you are not consciously deciding it.
Perhaps.
So even if we labeled it as us being counterculture rebellious, you know, on that subconscious level, it could have been.
Is a direct decision that we didn't.
Exactly. Right. I would take it more from a present standpoint. Like, I don't know, in the last 2-3 years, you have traveled. You enjoy traveling. You enjoy exploring places, but you don't like that type of game.
Right. This is true.
So I mean, can say the exact thing, same thing for myself. I mean, in this last year, I've been in more countries than I have in the years up to that times five. I still like a more sedentary game just because you can develop a setting over a course of time if you're not always moving. And we've talked about in earlier episodes the tour of the setting, the sightseeing through the setting hardback book, this 400 pages long, as a tactic of a less experienced or lazy GM to get out of developing a story. And that's what we're wary of.
You know, my biggest problem is with the traveling game. I love to develop the NPCs. I love to really dig into the who, the what, and the why of what they are, and ultimately piss you guys off with them.
That's brilliant.
Well, when you go into a town, you encounter the NPCs, and they do their thing, and then what do? You move on and leave them behind. I mean, you could bring one or two with them. You know, you could have an NPC group of
party. Yeah, you can have a guy carrying the boxes for you, but who cares?
The innkeeper, you're not going to have every single innkeeper of every single town you go to follow you along in this crusade. I guess you could, but that's going to be kind of a one-trick pony for your campaign, I would think.
It'd be the March of Children.
So if we're still talking about Lord of the Rings, Adam and John, I understand that you guys had some kind of an argument about Lord of the Rings. And I'm curious what this is all about.
We did. I'll let Adam set up the ball, and I'll toss it back to him.
It wasn't an argument, per se. It was a commentary on the dork subculture.
It was.
We've noticed an unsettling trend. Like, it used to be uncool to be a dork.
Right.
And there was that kind of whole subset of culture.
Right.
And now, that whole subset of culture was this big Lord of the Rings culture.
Exactly.
Like that whole fantasy Middle Earth type culture. There's now a subset of this subset that is like anti-Tolkien and Middle Earth.
I don't follow.
Well, 10 years ago, The Lord of the Rings was dorky.
Right.
I mean, you knew the story, I knew the story, but we weren't cool.
Exactly. I'm with you there.
Now that the movies are out, and everyone loves the movies, and most people that watch them want to know more.
It's become too pop.
We are more in the mainstream. In fact, I'm going to eliminate the relative modifier and say it is in the mainstream. Lord of the Rings is mainstream American fiction now, or British fiction in America. There's a certain stripe of gamer, dork, nerd person that really doesn't want to be in the mainstream at all.
Right.
And is and in we'll do, yeah. the hobby or the culture just to be on the periphery.
And so they'll hate Tolkien just because it's popular.
Exactly.
Yeah, they will go to that
now
extreme.
Now they have some author that either you don't like, or better yet, you've never heard of. Ooh, that is so much better than Tolkien.
I remember
this and that.
This whole thing with the when I was growing up, and I was in high school back in the early 90s with the alternative movement. Where with the alternative movement, they would sit around, like I remember sitting there in gym class, and they would sit around arguing about whose bands are less known, not better. Mind you, good had nothing to do with it. It's just, well, you've never heard of the things that I listen to. And kind of the way that I started to see this whole alternative movement was we are all different in the exact same way.
I did that to Aram, to Axe one time. I was like, hey, Aram, my favorite band's more obscure than your favorite band. And he just looked at me and he was like, oh, you want to bet? And I was like, dude, I'm just yanking your chain. My favorite band is Stone Temple Pilots.
That's a measuring contest I never want to look at.
Chad, you were going to say something?
Well, I was going to say, back on the Lord of the Rings thing, I don't see that so much with Lord of the Rings. I see it more with Harry Potter.
That's fair. That's fair.
Because I see because there's not much out there that is of the quality level of Lord of the Rings that people could say that, well, this alternative is so much better.
Exactly.
That's
without getting
true.
Into a deep
it's
debate.
It's like dissing Shakespeare. Yeah. You can't do it.
Whereas Harry Potter, there was tons of stuff that is as good, if not better, that has come out before, that where people can get, well, this is where Harry Potter ripped off of, or I was reading this way before, or that came out during or after, where they could say, oh, well, you read Harry Potter, well, you just don't know X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, Harry Potter doesn't have the genre creation that Lord of the Rings
does. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was on the opposite end of what happened to Lord of the Rings with Harry Potter. Initially, I didn't get into it at all, and then as it grew, I was one of the latecomers. I didn't pick it up until book 5 was well out. But
yeah,
now I'm
totally
anxiously waiting
now
for book 7.
Yeah, I just don't get why it's so hard to grasp. Like what you like and don't worry about who else likes it, where it came from. In fact, in debate, you have a logical fallacy called the genetic fallacy, which means downing an idea because of its roots or because of its origin. Yet for some reason in pop culture, there is so much baggage associated to where something came from. Like, I can see, quite plainly, that The Matrix blatantly ripped off Dark City. Yet I enjoyed the first Matrix movie. I still enjoy the first Matrix movie. Even after having seen Dark City, and I prefer Dark City to Matrix. But I can still say, you know what, I don't care what it ripped off. The Matrix was a good movie in its own right. I enjoyed it when I see it. I'm not going to suddenly stop liking it because it's too popular or because it ripped off XYZ or whatever.
Well, if the ripping off gets too blatant, it can become a violation of artistic integrity.
Yeah,
and then
all
you can
right.
denounce it for that.
Well, you can cross the line into plagiarism,
yeah,
but
exactly.
Assuming you haven't gone that far.
Where I jump in is when they rip off something, and ripping off is fine because, you know, that's
welcome
where
to the world.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, you draw inspiration from somewhere. My problem is when what they rip it off from was better and the end product of what you're making isn't. My view on that, and this is the one that people just totally are up in arms with, is Gladiator is based off of the Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, a movie made in the 50s, I think, which is, of course, based on the omnibus historical work, the multi-volume set of Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire.
Gibbon, who wrote it in the 19th century.
Which is based on life. But,
lies.
The movie from the 50s doesn't have all the special effects and doesn't have the huge violence and the blood and stuff, which was really cool in Gladiator. Instead, it has character development and story and plot and more drama.
I don't want that. I want more killing.
And you know what? A lot of people do.
Sure. I gotta say, though, in Gladiator, when they wanted to show the chaos of battle, how they did that play times two thing during all the battle scenes, that irritated the hell out of me.
You know what movie that I thought really portrayed battle well, without relying too heavily on special effects, was not really a great movie, but it was the most recent incarnation of Joan of Arc. It was the Luc Besson's Joan of Arc. You guys...
The Messenger?
The Messenger, that's it. And
oh, that's my girl Mila in it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She is the fifth element.
That's right.
Huh. But anyway, the battle that they did, it was really neat because they had all the knights in armor, and there's this infantry press, all these hundred, well, probably not hundreds of people, but made it look like hundreds and hundreds of men at arms just pressed into each other, trying to just do this back and forth push of fighting.
Taking that back to role-playing game, actually just morphing from one subject to another here. Have you noticed really how few people seem to know very much? And, you know, I think humbly I'd put myself into the subject about the way that battle tends to go down. Like in a lot of fantasy books, when a big battle's coming up, big battles are hard to write about. And so you just kind of brush over them, or you have the hero get knocked out. And I remember like in the Lord of the Rings movie where the battles were pseudo accurate, but it was always very singular. You never had, like, an infantry at the same time as, like...
Wait a minute. Lord of the Rings, the battles were pseudo-accurate. Giant war elephants. No, I mean, waves of undead.
But here's the thing. Even within the suspension of disbelief. I mean, you still had basic medieval weapons and formations.
You had cavalry charges and flanking.
Yeah, and you had siege tactics and all that. But it's always one of these things happened at a time. It was never like a lot of complexity occurring there. And we had someone in our forums ask, you know, where do you go to learn more about that kind of thing? Like if you want to portray battles more accurately in terms of how all these elements actually fit together to form a real military action back in that time. And I'm trying to think some of the things that we recommended people look at to...
Did you just morph our banter topic into an advice topic?
I did.
Oh, my God.
You're disgusting.
So, wait, let me just to clarify this question so I can answer it. You're asking where people can go if they want to learn how to portray the old-style formation battles
correctly. Right, like a real medieval battle.
What I would recommend doing is reading a book, Sun Tzu's Art of War, because you cannot line up the formations and you cannot portray that unless you know... the philosophy behind them,
yeah,
why
course,
you're lining this
Sun
up.
Sun Tzu is mostly philosophy, but yeah, that's still
no, that's
important.
The point. That's the exact point of why you would do that.
History Channel also, as simple as it is a great place to go. They have a lot of stuff on that where they'll actually like draw out this formation was here and this formation was there and they brought this up around the back. And you got to catch the right shows. But on the right shows on History Channel, they have a lot of that. You know, there was a pair of guys, I could not tell you their names for life of me, who apparently got a hold of some like Renaissance era manual on how to actually sword fight. And these guys, based on all these documents they had reassembled, actually resurrected the proper style of sword fighting. And I was watching them demonstrate how these fights actually would go. And I tell you, it is very different than what you're used to seeing in popular media.
Oh, popular media is god awful.
For example, the whole thing about don't touch your blade is complete crap. They use that blade almost like in popular media, you would see somebody use a bowkin. I mean, they grab that sword, would block with both hands on it. One hand on the blade, one hand on the hilt, would block with it and move with it. And there's all these like punches and kicks that were involved in it. It was a very, very, well, it was not at all like Errol Flynn.
Yeah, I was going to bring up the Errol Flynn example where waving the sword in a circle above your head, propeller-like, somehow charges up the hit. But
you glow brighter and brighter with each swing.
Well,
I don't blame him for that. I don't think that the old Errol Flynn Robin Hood is bad because they weren't going for accuracy. I mean, he was wearing spandex.
It was even little things like, for example, you do not ever. One of the things they tried to avoid, of course, in the heat of battle, you do what you have to survive. But one of the things they tried to avoid was you do not block blade to blade because the other guy's blade will take a big notch out of yours. So you always try to block with flat to blade.
Yeah,
or just little things like that. Yeah, or you try to deflect. Or they said that the best way to dodge these things was not to be there, to step aside from them, which once again is really different than how you see it portrayed in popular media.
Well, and popular media is just that. It's popular and it's media. It's going for the most entertaining.
It's not entertaining
dramatic.
Unless there are sparks when the swords meet.
Yeah, or you do the Highlander thing where both swords cross and people are 3 inches from their face and they deliver the, I am going to kill you because you destroyed.
There can be only one.
There can
only be one.
Yeah. You know,
Christopher Lambert can only deliver one line. And did you see that Beowulf movie? Like, he would say dialogue, and you can just, like, his lips would be itching to say, there can be only one Beowulf.
Wow.
I haven't seen this movie.
It's awful.
I read the original book, and...
The original book was awesome.
Yeah, it was.
And then Grendel, the book told from the monster's perspective,
was also awesome.
It was really good too, but it was a different. Whereas one was the media and the myth and the society,
like the medieval literature. Grendel was modern.
Grendel was a book of philosophy.
Beowulf was written 1,000 years before Grendel was.
Well, Grendel wasn't trying to entertain. I mean, it was trying to entertain, but it was basically a philosophy book. It was saying these types of philosophies, and Grendel was trying to work through them and stuff. Oh, and it was just sort of like the Tao of Piglet sort of thing. It was just this veil to deliver the philosophical
I've never
message.
Read
tangent,
this book.
Tangent.
This book has the potential to be horrible.
Grendel or the Tao of Piglet?
Well, I was talking about Grendel, but you know, either one.
No, Grendel was
Grendel
really
was
good.
Was it?
I've never read it. But. Yeah.
It didn't suffer the same monastic turning a myth into a Christian story problem, like that melding of two different cultures that Beowulf had.
Oh, Beowulf had ripping off of arms. I mean,
Beowulf was awesome, though. Don't get me wrong.
He's like, I don't need armor. I don't even need a sword.
I don't need any of you. All of you leave the room. I have some ass to kick.
Yeah, I'm all out of bubble gum.
Well, clearly our literature peens are long and robust. But moving on to the next topic, Dan, what's our advice topic of the day?
All right, our advice topic.
Advice peen.
Our advice peen for the day, continuing our game design series. Today we are going to talk about the macro setting. Now, we have talked about so far big topics we've hit are the field document, and we have talked about the backstory. We've talked about conceptualizing, setting the foundations of math and such. Now that we have our feel and our setting, our feel and our story in place, rather,
we get to killing.
We are ready to move on to setting.
No,
sorry, Adam. Killing is yet to come.
The forum users demand the killing.
The forum users have demanded killing, but
let's drop a little hint. Killing will involve the rolling of dice. More later.
Oh, I know. You just got about 50 guys all hot and bothered.
We will come back to killing, but I actually believe it's about 3 episodes from now, because I think, and this, don't quote me on this, but the next one is going to be micro setting, after which we're going to talk about art and production, a little bit of production. And then after that, I believe we are finally getting into what everyone or a lot of people have wanted, which is discussions on rules. For those of you that are really interested in the numbers and the rules and such, just sit tight. We are going to get to that. But we have always felt that when you were talking about a game where the setting and rules are closely married together, that the setting should drive the rules. The rules should be an expression of the setting, not the other way around. And so we want to emphasize that by designing the setting and the story and all the what we've been calling the softer parts of the game first, before we get into all the hard numbers and addition, subtraction, division, all those little things. So today we're talking about the macro setting. We are defining the macro setting as the people, places, and things that figure into the entire broad story.
So we're talking broad nouns.
We're talking very, very big stuff. For example, your minor locations may be impacted by the macro setting, but they're not necessarily accounted for by it. Okay, let's talk an example. If we were creating a game about World War II, things like the propeller plane would be in the macro setting. Winston Churchill would be in the macro setting. London may be mentioned in the macro setting. Now, some place like our home city of St. Louis, Missouri, certainly it existed during World War II, but ultimately this place, while it was accounted for, while it was impacted by that macro story, the big overarching story of the Earth as a whole, it was not accounted for by that story. There was no Great Battle of St. Louis during World War II.
Lies. I don't have anything to back that up.
I think there's a convention right now in Iran that's centered for people.
Oh, my.
Yowza.
Can anyone say the Iranian PM's name? Ahmadinejad.
Ahmadinejad?
There you go.
Yeah.
All right.
I listen to too much
getting
NPR.
Getting too political.
I'm impressed. Anyway, gaming.
Yeah. So getting away from politics and back into gaming.
Excellent.
Now, we want to differentiate between this and the micro setting in that the macro setting is consistent across all places. So once again, if you're talking about a fantasy setting where you have this big realm, the macro setting are the places, the people, and the things that figure into the vast majority of the places you can go. This is not the stuff that necessarily defines the individual little cities. And within Skies of Glass, as we have said many times, we are really, for the sake of our game, this is purely a Skies of Glass idiosyncrasy, we are putting a lot of our development effort into that micro setting So expect to see a little bit of kind of a weakness in our macro setting versus the macro setting that you would expect to see in most games.
Well, I think that the weakness in the macro setting kind of propagates the feel of the world is shattered. No one thinks of things on the macro level anymore.
Let's talk about that, actually. You bring up a good point.
I know I do.
That the macro setting is one of the most important places that you are going to express your feel. Because even in the macro story, which we talked about last podcast, you can kind of get away with stepping around your feel a little bit because you can just say, well, the world was a different place before our game occurred. But now you have to use one of my favorite phrases, the rubber has hit the road.
Oh, yes,
that's
sir.
Right. You guys know you were waiting for that one. The game has now started. This is the first thing we have talked about that really powerfully fits into the here and now today of your game. And so this macro setting is one of your first opportunities to really express your feel document.
I agree.
Excellent.
Huh. No one else was going to say anything.
Now, since you agree, Adam, why don't you go ahead and tell us about a game you can think of where the macro setting has done a really good job of expressing the feel of the game?
I'm just going to fall back on Battletech.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I mean, I know we discussed off the podcast how we didn't want to use that as our example every single time, but...
Okay, I'm listening.
Well, there's a whole desperation feel to Battletech, this whole lost technology, and I think that the houses not having the ability to create their own battle mechs really propagates that feel.
Okay, I can accept that. So if we were at FASA 20-ish years ago when they were...
They'd be paying us out the ass because we... Yeah. Shill their product every single week.
Yeah. And since there's tons of money involved in, you know, writing and publishing a role-playing game and all.
But I'm already lighting my cigars off of burning $100 bills just in anticipation of Skies of Glass.
Same here. I've cashed out my 401k.
Oh, and don't need it anymore.
I spent it all on lottery tickets and such. So. But that's a good example that if we were writing Battletech, you might put in the field document that you want there to be sort of a low-tech sense of desperation to the world. And you could express that within the macro setting by saying that the battle mechs are rare, that the factories and technologies that are actually used to build these things are extremely rare. And as you write that macro setting, you would, as you maybe write your little entries on each of the individual successor states, you might write out the number of factories they have, and it might be relatively small.
All right, somebody else come up with an example.
I think a game that has a great macro setting, and I'm going to about face from last week because I criticized this game very harshly, is World of Warcraft. Their micro settings make no sense. I mean, the equator has these glacial zones. Ironforge is in the middle of the world. It's snowing all the time. But no one cares. I love the game universe just because it just has this feel. It has this sort of steampunky, post-Tolkienian... Well, even post-Games Workshopian orc and human feel to it.
The example you were given before we started recording is the fact that with World of Warcraft, part of their feel is that the whole world is somewhat lighthearted.
It is very lighthearted. Even the darker zones, the terrible challenges and the dangers that lurk in the sides are kind of goofy.
Yeah, an example is when you are in the arena in Upper Blackrock Spire, and they're unleashing all these monsters in an attempt to kill you.
Yes.
And to scatter your bones all over this arena and feed your remains to all these horrible monsters, and somebody goes down, what is it that the guy up top...
He says, you got served.
Yeah, you got served.
Rand is like, nobody roll on that armor. Those are my boots, or something like that. They have a bunch of comments. I think he says woot as well. It's just, they have a world that has a lot of different little mini feels to it in a lot of different places.
Right.
But it's all united under this sort of theme of tongue-in-cheek fantasy that everyone just logs on to have fun.
Mm-hmm. I think another important thing that your macro setting is going to do, or at least you need to keep in mind when you're writing it up, is limits. And this is something that we have talked about with other subjects, but I don't think we've really specifically leveled against game design yet. Maybe we did a little bit with the field document. But that, for example, within your field document, if you said that you want there to be very limited technology, like what we're doing in Skies of Glass, if we now, as we write our macro setting, we start going out and making... Like across North America, there are 24 different places that still have a pre-bomb high-tech civilization left.
We have failed our feel.
We just destroyed the feel. That suddenly this post-nuke game really doesn't play like a post-nuke game anymore. It plays like a pre-nuke game where there's a few problems in somebody else's city.
Yeah.
and you create your worker and you tell him to clean up the radioactive material.
Other examples would be if, let's say, we were writing a sci-fi game and we wanted one particular race to be the high-tech race that has this mysterious technology, and they represent the leading edge and the leading edge and the great big power brokers of the universe. And then suddenly, with every source book or every city or every planet or whatever you want to talk about, we introduce a race or a technology cache or whatever it may be that's more powerful and more powerful and more powerful. Adam, the example you were giving when we were talking about this was that if you took Call of Cthulhu, and in every single source book, we unleashed a demon that was even more powerful. And then we unleashed the anti-demon guns in the next source book. And then a more powerful demon. And then a more powerful anti-demon gun. Well, pretty soon, Cthulhu, he has no significance left anymore.
Now we're just rubbing ourselves with numbers.
I think War Machine almost runs the risk of doing that, because I'm talking to the players, I'm reading the books, and it's like, oh, well, this thing is awesome. It can beat the crap out of anything else. And that's the mechs. And then I look up the cavalry, and it's like, oh, well, they're unstoppable. They'll destroy you all. And I look up the infantry, and it's, well, there's just this endless horde, and they can take down anything in their path. So, yeah.
No, I think what it is in War Machine, it's a lot of flexing. People pick out their favorite unit or whatever, and then they're just like, yeah, I'm a jack player.
That's what the entire War Machine forum is on the field.
Well, yeah,
forums.
I recognize
just
it with
flexing.
It's
it's like that with classes in WoW, and
it's an incredibly balanced game, though. I see it as, and
it's just everything is really powerful and really cool, and it's
right. Oh,
anything can beat the crap out of anything else.
That's the great thing about the game. It's the cool factor of the game is wonderful.
So I guess that really does fit its macro setting. All right, I take it back. It does a good job. Next thing,
excellent. Privateer Press, thumbs up.
Now, Chad, one of the things you had talked about is how macro setting also sets genre.
Right. I was giving the example that with genre, you can have Blade Runner and you have LA. Oh. And it's, besides being just wonderful, LA is dark, it's dirty, it's filled with all these different cultures. Nobody really speaks English, nobody really speaks any one language, and it has the Blade Runner feel to it. But then you have a movie like LA Confidential, where it's LA. It's the same place, the same streets, the same people, filled with people who are multicultural and nobody really speaks English.
I don't know. I didn't see any Ugnaughts in L.A. Confidential, dude.
Yeah, well, I didn't see any Bionics or anything like that either. It's a totally different feel. It's the same setting, but it's a different macro setting that completely changes the feel or the genre. I mean, to me, that's really important when it comes to setting and macro setting.
Yep, a macro setting is so strong that any micro setting within it is radically altered.
Right, right.
Good stuff.
And that's an important distinction to make, is that your micro setting ultimately derives from that macro setting, just as the macro setting derives from the field document. Now, it's a little harder in some ways to draw that distinction between macro story and macro setting. That we can definitely talk about how in our minds that feel really should come first. But when you're talking about the macro story and the macro setting, well, really, the macro setting is the specifics of that macro story. As I mentioned World War II before, that you don't have a World War II if you don't have places like Berlin and people like Hitler and places like London and people like Churchill. You have some completely different series of events than what we had unfold in actual world history. In fact, when we were kicking this off, we had some debate amongst ourselves about whether really story or setting should even come first. Because depending on the kind of game you're developing, you may want to create a particular setting, and then the story derives from the setting. That if you have these three different kingdoms that have all kind of angst over one particular common issue, well, that may create a war, versus sitting down and saying, well, we want a war between three kingdoms, and then writing three kingdoms that would have that kind of interest in a war and creating a setting that would foster that sort of war between them.
I remember that debate. Actually, we had lumped all of the macro setting and story, and then the micro setting and story all into one thing. And then as we started talking about it, it was like, this is not the same thing. This is something that we need to break apart and look at separately.
Yeah, and almost in some ways, the difference at first seems a little bit nitpicky until you really start to understand the color of it.
Well, once you start developing one, then you're going to see how drastically different it is from the other one.
Yeah, you can't tell one without the other, really, and one drives the other. And it almost seems like at the highest level you're talking about the difference between noun and verb. That the macro setting is the who and the what and the where, whereas the macro story is the hows and the whys and all these sorts of things. So with our game, for example, Skies of Glass, we have talked about how with our feel we wanted desperation and minimal technology. And then with the story we just released, we talked about a world being nuked. And so now as we go back and talk about the macro setting, we have to create a setting that logically follows from the story and enables the feel. And that's why on the resources section on feartheboot.com, I'm going to be releasing some documents that will talk a little bit about the technology that's in the world, but also we're going to talk about some of the places. So if we are developing our macro setting, let's talk about some of the steps that someone should go through to actually create that macro setting. We've already talked about feel and its importance. So just for the sake of saying it, let's repeat, dig up your feel document and let that be your beginning guide. Don't stray from that as you develop your setting, because if you do, you're using your setting to undermine what it is you're actually trying to accomplish through this game.
Would you say you could go straight down your feel document, and if you do not satisfy every single point on there conveyed through your feel, you have somehow failed in your macro store or setting?
Yes. In fact, I'd almost say you can go a step beyond that. That if you look at your feel document, depending on how well you've developed that, your feel document could almost become like a casting call.
Like a checklist?
Yeah, exactly. That if you're like, okay, in our feel document, we want to have one last refuge of mankind, well, check that off and pick a city to be your last refuge of mankind. If you've talked about how we want there to be this great wasteland in between all these refugees, you can check that off and now start developing the places and the technologies that are necessary to enable that kind of an expression of the feel.
I don't know if I would call missing a few points abject failure as much as I'd call it deviation. I think very, very few creative endeavors are exactly what their creators initially envisioned they would
be. Well, I would take that a step further to say that just because you've left a point off doesn't mean you've missed it.
Exactly.
Like hope being absent. There being hope, just because you don't have any specific examples
of it.
There's
the city of hope.
Check it off. Precisely. Yeah. Precisely. Mm-hmm. That could be the result
of
other things.
Yeah, I think, there's an nth extreme where you can get cheesy, where, there should be no city of hope. But you can say, though, what in my setting, once you can kind of take this casting call sort of mentality, what in my setting will express that hope?
That's fair.
And that may not be, I think, if you just rush down to that's a city or that's a person, that may be appropriate to your setting, but I got to think that in most cases that's just going to be outright cheesy. So instead, you may have to use a little bit more subtlety and say that hope may not be a person, but may be a series of people or a series of movements, or it may be an element that appears within these different cities throughout the realm.
And you should at least have a couple reasons you can point to and say, okay, this is why my setting is not one of complete and abject despair and terror.
Right. And we also mentioned way back when that your feel document through these early parts of game development is going to be a little bit fluid. That it should be a difficult move to change it, but not an impossible one. That really it only becomes set in stone once you are done and have released a product. Now you run the risk of destroying your own product by altering that feel. But now's the time to realize, you know what, I screwed up, that my feel as I'm expressing it through the setting just comes out ridiculous for whatever reason.
And yeah.
I mean, I still feel pretty comfortable Skies of Glass feel, but I can tell you right now, I've developed other games where I didn't. Once I started doing the setting, I realized big problems in the setting that were being triggered by the feel document.
No, if you read through your game and you're like, this is ridiculous for any reason, something's wrong.
Just chuck it.
Well, not chuck it, but something's
wrong.
Don't
chuck the game, but find out which of your two checkpoints make each other stupid and get rid of one of them.
All right, we've talked about how these setting has to come off of the feel. How would you talk about setting being related to the story?
It's got to be the end result of the story.
Does the story have to be the end result of the setting?
So you're saying the story expresses the setting?
No, I'm saying that the story is the arc of time causes that lead you to the point in time where your setting is, and your setting is the result of that past however many years that have brought you to this point where all of your objects
are. Okay, I buy it.
And see, this gets into the difficulty of how we chose to develop this, because that chicken and the egg, which comes first, story and setting. But
yeah,
that's
a pain in the butt.
In the order we chose to do it, it's kind of a 1+1=2, that feel plus story equals setting. That if you talk about we talked about in our story document about how the world's been nuked, well, obviously part of our consistent setting has to be that the vast majority of cities have been nuked. Now, if you chose to flip this where for whatever reason, you are trying to develop the feel and the setting first and then go from that to a story. And the easiest example I can think of this is if you already have a setting in mind. Maybe you're developing a popular movie, TV series, or book series into a game, or maybe you just kind of sitting there in your free time thought, man, wouldn't it be cool to have a city that's like this? And now you're trying to create a story out of it. But I guess really you just kind of flip the equation that if you've got a feel in mind and now you've got a setting, well, probably there is some kind of story that expresses that feel that is enabled by that setting that you can tell from that. For example, if you want to talk about this struggle between good and evil, well, you look at your setting and here's a good guy, here's an evil guy. Well, there's your story. This good guy and this evil guy have to have some kind of squabble that's going to enable your story to come out of that.
And then ultimately that squabble ends and then there goes your story out the window.
Well, right, which is why we talked about being careful not to box yourself into a singular story.
Great for a novel, terrible for a persistent fictional setting.
Yeah, or if you're trying to do a more realistic setting, you know, very few people are truly evil or truly good.
Yeah, I think that's a pitfall that you should avoid.
Yeah.
And this something else we got to think about, and this figures more probably into modern games than it does into fantasy games, but we'll figure into fantasy games as well. We've talked a lot about the people and places, the great heroes and generals and bad guys and the cities, their planets they fight over. But something else you also have to think of in there in your macro settings is technology. What kinds of tools and weapons and ships and whatever else do people tend to have in daily life? And, you know, I realize this is going to vary a little bit from place to place, but if you look at the current world, something like the internet is part of our macro setting. And in your world, you can say things like, for example, if you're doing a fantasy setting, do people have gunpowder? Is this anywhere? Do some people have it? Does nobody have it? Because the introduction of gunpowder is going to change things in your world.
And in a fantasy setting, is gunpowder science or is it magic?
Yeah, and in a science fiction setting, what is the most powerful kind of weapon out there, most powerful kind of ship out there, and who has it? And why do they have it as opposed to anyone else?
And do be careful to consider the ramifications of what you put in. For example, gunpowder. If cannon is in the world, there better not be any new castle walls getting sprung up unless their constructors are truly idiots. There might be old ones, but they're gone now. Because they can be smashed with relative ease, there's no reason for them.
I don't necessarily agree with that statement.
Oh, why not?
Because, well, this is an awful tangent, but I don't think that walls and such have left us because of the invention of gunpowder, nor do I think body armor has left us because of the invention of gunpowder. All through history, they just changed the way that the walls were made and the walls were set up, and then they posted cannons along those walls. If you look at the Statue of Liberty, Statue of Liberty sits on a fortress. The star shape that the pedestal sits on.
Centellian fortress, yeah.
There are static defenses to this day. They've morphed. Okay, let me clarify. Make sure things change as they're supposed to. Don't make it the pikeman wall with the archer battalions when everyone and his mother has got a cannon.
That I have to agree with.
Okay.
Allow your setting to impact itself.
There you go.
Or play Civilization for about an hour or two.
You know, another piece of setting that I think is sometimes overlooked that adds a lot of color to your world, and this adds no functional purpose in the story, it's just really good to helping you develop the micro setting later, is major sites. Like, for example, if we talk about the macro setting of 21st century Earth, you can talk about places like the Statue of Liberty, the site where the World Trade Center used to stand. You can talk about the Eiffel Tower in Paris. These are things that figure into our worldwide sort of consciousness or culture that, yeah, granted, these don't necessarily involve, I guess with the exception of the World Trade Center, these are not necessarily the center of great world events, but nonetheless, these things help add a lot of color and flavor to your world setting. And these are the kinds of things that people are aware of at the world level. These are not local hotspots. These are things that you go to most people any place and they are aware of these particular sites being somewhere out there in the world. And I guess as you look at your story, and once again, this depends a little bit on the game and on the story, but your story may call out to you that, you know, there should be a major memorial for this battle or this great big ship where it crashed on this one planet has maybe become a big important site. And that's going to help you develop that culture later on.
Crashed on a planet? Dan, do I smell Spelljammer on your breath?
No.
What have you been doing?
No, this is not Spelljammer. I was thinking more like sci-fi space opera kind of thing.
Okay.
Somebody's great big 3-mile long warship crashed
on
a planet.
We're okay.
Oops. But that navigator got fired.
Can you guys think of any games that do macro setting poorly? Any big pitfalls there?
Not really.
Coming up with one, really, which is when they fail to define it at all.
What's that?
Like, well, we were
Rifts.
Rifts, for example, where there's insufficient material on the macro setting. Because it really strikes me that as long as you have that macro setting defined, as long as you've kind of said, look, this is what populates my world, and assuming that you've been consistent to your field, assuming that you have enabled the story you have set forth and not limited yourself and all the things we talked about in the story episode, it strikes me with the macro setting, the only way you can go wrong is not having it.
Because, yeah, I agree with that. Like, would you think that Dungeons & Dragons is a good example of that?
Well, maybe.
Dungeons & Dragons settings?
Dungeons & Dragons is a rule system more than
I was going to go with the 3.0 book, but...
Right, but I mean, that's more of a rule system than a setting, but...
Yeah.
You can't blame GURPS and you can't blame Hero System. It's the same way.
Because, like, we could sit here and talk about how we individually may not like this setting or that setting, but ultimately what we're coming down to is matters of personal taste, not some objective standard of they failed because blah, blah, blah. And anything I would come up with like that, I'd have to draw back to either they failed the feel or they failed the story, not they failed the setting individually.
We could point to self-contradiction outright as a means of failure, but, I mean, Chad and I don't like Shadowrun. That doesn't mean it has a terrible macro setting. It just means we don't like it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But if you look at what the intended feel of Shadowrun was, the setting does a wonderful job of conveying that feel, and it does a wonderful job of enabling its own story. And so I'm just really struggling to come up with anything outside of failing to write a macro setting.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the after the bomb. Not the base game, because the base games are based on the comic books or maybe the cartoons. And that is where your macro setting comes from. The supplemental stuff, like the Turtles in Time type stuff, and then the after the bomb stuff, it's just like the entire macro setting is world gets nuked, creates crazy mutants. Now have fun. That is an example.
It's the greatest game ever, and I want to play it right now.
The macro setting is missing.
I have Turtles in Time for the Super Nintendo.
How would you define that? Because it almost strikes me like that's a failure of feel and story.
Well, it's a failure of its absence. It doesn't fail because it's bad. It fails because it doesn't exist.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, yeah, when you ask for, like, I guess you look at the old TMNT games, what's in them? Well, a nuked world and mutants, and that's really there's really not a specific series of...
I think that games that are based on franchises do great. Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Army of Darkness, the role-playing game, and Babylon 5, the role-playing game. Even if you don't think they're good systems, you don't like them, or you even love them, you have this macro setting that has been established by the TV series or comic book series or whatever that the game is actually based on. And the only thing that the role-playing game designers need to succeed at is they need to be able to present enough of that to kind of get the ball rolling.
Yeah, if you're doing an established setting, you get off easy at the setting stage because all you have to do is take notes.
Yep.
And really the worst job you are left with is resolving contradiction, where in episode A they said it worked this way, and in episode B they completely contradicted that. Star Trek would be a good example of that.
Yeah, Star Trek, one of the things that they had to explain in the role-playing game is that in old Trek, the Klingons didn't have the big turtle shells on their head. In the Next Generation stuff, which the Fastest Star Trek game covered, they did. Well, you have to explain that in a role-playing game.
Yeah, and there's
game.
Also their differences in their culture and stuff between the two that they really had to explain.
I think there's another danger with an established setting, and that is capturing the proper feel. For example, if we're playing the Gladiator role-playing game and we're gladiators, we better be able to kick some butt. But if we're playing a darker, more imminently...
A two
mortal
Brutus
one.
Brute,
yeah, exactly.
The role-playing game, yeah.
We should be able to die pretty quick.
Yeah.
And your own...
Because you don't want the assassination of Caesar to take 32 rounds.
No. And in your own game, you really can't betray your own feel because you make it.
Caesar has to get up from the table and go grab a Mountain Dew and some pretzels.
Caesar's AC is 25. Senators are level 2 nobles with clubs doing 0 damage.
Revolution, failure.
Not today. You rolled a 1. Back to dictatorship.
For the Skies of Glass Q&A today, We got three we're going to do. We've decided that we're going to start crediting these questions because we weren't doing that before. So my apologies to people we took questions from before. We are now going to start crediting these. So our first question today comes from on our forums, a guy named I Found Goldbug. And by the way, if you want to get in on this, please stop by feartheboot.com, sign up on the forums, give us your 2 cents on Skies of Glass or the show or heck, whatever's going on in your gaming life in general.
I have a question.
Sure.
What is I Found Goldbug reference? I don't get the joke.
He found a yellow Volkswagen bug.
Oh.
Yes. Huh, that's absolutely. Cool.
Did cool. you just make that up?
I yeah. did. And that's
was
where
that,
I will stand.
Was that from that book that came out, the big scavenger hunt? Because that'd be really cool. This book came out. Mm-hmm. Don can tell you about this.
Yeah.
This book came out, and inside the book, it's a 60-page book full of clues,
uh-huh.
and they are hard to decipher.
Yeah.
Well, they point to locations around the nation.
When I was at my office party for the holidays, the guy that I was talking to about Fear the Boot, he was trying to get me into that kind of stuff. He was talking about all these sites and stuff that are into these big, huge, like, puzzle-solving things, and mm-hmm. there's one clue in San Francisco, and one clue in D.C., and one clue in Minneapolis, and you fly all over the nation, but if you actually manage to win, it's like $100,000.
Yeah, one, yeah.
Apparently, these games are pretty popular. Yeah. I just don't...
I wonder if he kept bees.
Kept bees?
Yeah. Maybe. Kept bees.
Like the animals, the insects.
Kept bees.
He plays a lot of games.
I think he did. He probably did keep bees.
All right. Are you talking about that beekeeper game? What is that called?
Maybe. I'm trying to be mysterious. Yeah, the I Keep Bee thing. It's over
beekeeper
with now. The Halo.
Yeah, that.
Yeah.
Or Australian Goldfinch for Prison Break. New England Goldfinch.
All right.
Whoa. He has a website.
Was his question?
As brilliant as all this is, I Found Goldbug wants to know what percentage of the planet was bombed. Specifically, and I quote,
103%.
Was the strategic targets taken out, or is it something along the lines of atomic carpet bombing? The answer is somewhere between the two. Per our field document, I realize in the field document we did not reveal the exact conspiracy that went into the bombing, which we probably will not release until well into the game's life cycle. But specifically, population centers were being nuked. So unlike a proper military nuking, they were not going after just military bases and industrial centers. They were going after clusters of people. So while this was not exactly carpet bombing, they weren't just trying to obliterate the countryside. Nonetheless, they were attempting to specifically exterminate human life. So the answer to his question is a little bit between the two.
Who are they?
I don't know, Chad. Why don't you listen to Fear the Boot for the next few months?
Oh.
And then buy Skies of Glass.
Our next question comes from Mr. Plug. And actually, Mr. Plug didn't have a question. He just made a point that we want to elaborate on. Mr. Plug made the point that several cities are fairly large urban sprawls. And the point that kind of comes out of this is that an atomic bomb, while it can blow up obviously a really freaking big area, it is not going to take out a major urban center from one edge to the other. They just don't destroy that kind of an area. And so we are taking that into account into the game, where you may go to a big city, and yeah, the urban center of it is obliterated, but all the suburbs and the sprawl that have sprung up around it are still standing.
Well, they're still standing, but the society and culture there is
collapsed,
shattered and collapsed.
You have killed, blinded, irradiated so many people there that it's not as if life went on normally, even though, I mean, effectively 3/4 of the city may still be standing. So, important distinction there.
I'm going to say that a lot of the, 50 years after the fact, a lot of the destruction is not from the bombs.
Yeah.
It is from the collapse of society.
But that's, you know, that's kind of an important point there about what this game is about. Is that you're correct, 50 years after the bomb, the radiation has passed, a lot of the initial disturbances have settled, society has stabilized. This game is not about surviving the moment after the bomb. This game is more about society as you knew it is gone, and people are now trying to say, look, we've got these ashes of what used to be. What kind of world are we going to build out of it? And that is what the game is about, is people trying to find some way forward and determine what kind of world they want to build that hopefully will not repeat these same mistakes.
And I see the conflict of SOG, like the sort of thematic conflict, the overall conflict of it, is that the world destroyed itself, and now it was, for 50 years, it was just a struggle to rebuild and survive. And now society is just starting to get to the point again to where it can start making mistakes again.
Yeah, that's actually a very good way of putting it. Society is now calm enough and further and far enough away from the event that it is willing to screw up again.
Nice.
Maybe not on a world nuking level, but on a destroy itself from the inside sort of way. Well, many, many different ways. That's what the game's about. That's where the play of the game comes in.
Our third question is from Francis.
Hi, Francis.
And Francis asks, what about hydrogen bombs? Very little fallout, but much more destructive living things. So says the almighty Wikipedia. If we're talking about things like neutron bombs and such, we're simply not dealing with them. The intention from the way we were writing the game was to obliterate, and therefore what was being used was your standard atomic bombs. These are not things like, you know, do neutron bursts or EM bursts or anything like that.
They didn't make special sci-fi missiles just for this game.
Things came down. You had your heat wave, compression, decompression, all that kind of stuff. This is your standard nuking. I realize those kinds of bombs do exist in the real world today, but that just is not what was launched on a wide scale for our event. And therefore, you know, we may pick one or two cities that got hit by a hydrogen bomb, neutron bomb, whatever, EM pulse
for
some special.
Well, a hydrogen bomb is the standard nuclear bomb of the day. I think most of the United States stockpile is hydrogen. Oh, well, it's a research topic.
Yeah, exactly.
Good point. To look into.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was kind of under the same impression you are that a hydrogen bomb is a standard atomic bomb.
It is,
bomb,
yeah. It just makes a bigger explosion than a uranium bomb.
Yeah, which was my understanding, too. But there is a different kind of bomb I think he may be getting at, which is the neutron bomb, which releases a wave of neutrons that disintegrates like carbon-based matter, like life, but there's no
explosion, there's no wall of fire, there's no compression.
We could be, our understanding could be dead wrong on this, but this is something we need to research.
Yeah. Oh, you think?
Yeah.
But just to be clear, what we are going for here is the standard atomic airburst bomb, not a high-altitude EM bomb, not some kind of neutron wave. We're going for the regular plain old nukes. So that's the answer.
Hiroshima, Francis. Nagasaki, destruction.
But just to make sure we have our terminology right, Francis, you've raised a good point. We are going to have to research to make sure we don't make fools out of ourselves later down the road.
Thanks, Francis, for creating more work for us.
Where did Francis get his name?
That's his name.
Yeah, I know.
You know him.
Real name. I know.
Jeff Brilliant. Chad, where's your form handle from?
Where's any of our form handles? Yeah, I had to change mine when we started.
Did you really?
Yeah. I put in my standard handle, and then
I told
Dan
Tex
yelled
that
at me.
If he ever appears on another episode, I'm going to make him change his too from Percenter to Tex. But
Tex is a nickname.
Oh, Tex is close. You know, somebody asked me once what his real name was, and I had to think about it. So Tex is as close as we get to real name for him. Anyway, thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you all next time.
Oh, such a sudden ending.
Whoa.
Shut up, Adam. Chad, thank you.
Hey, I'm Chad this week. See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2006, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in this show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.